What's up, everybody? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 201, The Next Generation. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me this week, James Jones.
Hey.
Mop your brow, son. I know it's hot in Virginia. And, of course, Greg Lay.
Hello.
Yes, and John, unfortunately, is working late this week, so we hope to have him back next time. I'm actually going to be out next week on a planned trip to Barcelona, so wish me luck with that.
Could be pretty crazy in Barcelona if they've just won the World Cup by the time this episode goes out.
Johnny might be killed by a drunk Spaniard.
Yes, I will be in Spain during the final game of the World Cup, which includes Spain. So,
by the way, I've just pissed off all of our no Spanish listeners.
it's going to be interesting. I might actually get to watch a World Cup game in one of the competing countries while it's going on.
Yeah, well, it'd be pretty feverish. Spain never even been to the semifinal before.
Yeah.
But I heard a rumor that John was not working tonight. I heard a rumor that he was in fact preparing a one-hour television event to announce which podcast he's going to.
The bald decision.
Anyway, we're going to have a quick show for you this week. It's just the three of us. So, kicking it off with new business, I'll go first. For a couple weeks, I've been playing Trauma Team. So I wanted to report in on it. I'm still really pretty early. It's probably just because it's such a big game.
It's huge.
It is, like I think Neil said in his review, it's like Trauma Center 6-in-1. It is a big game, and the big draw for me is the fact that there is all this variety, and so I'm kind of trying to spread it out among the different characters rather than, like, stick with one and go straight through.
Are you following them, like, because they're on tiers, so, like, these story events happen about the same time. Are you following those tiers?
Yeah, but, you know, the interface, it doesn't make it really clear how those things sync up.
Because things on the same tier might happen not at the same time.
Yeah, I'm not overly concerned about that. Yeah. I'm just kind of trying to spread it out just for the sake of variety, you know, in gameplay. But I do like pretty much all the tiers, all the different activities, all the different doctors that you can play as. My first experience with endoscopy was pretty bad, but it was partly because I was playing two-player with a friend. And the way it did in endoscopy, because you don't have two endoscopes in the patient, that would be totally overkill. So instead of having you both work on it at the same time, you're taking turns and it switches out like every 10 seconds. It was really fast. And so we're both trying to learn this weird control scheme that they've got and figure out what it wants us to do. And we're getting lost and disoriented because I guess that's part of the mode, is that you can easily get disoriented when you're in there. It was just mass confusion, and I haven't gone back to try it again by myself. I imagine it'll make somewhat more sense.
I'm surprised they actually have two-player mode in the endoscopy one, because I thought, well, there's no way they're going to do it this one.
I think they all have two-player modes in some form or another.
Except for the, you know, the point-and-click adventure parts.
Yeah.
Where they'd really make no sense.
I actually, you know, the one with Dr. Kimishima, the investigation, you know, the medical examiner, that's my favorite part so far.
Oh, they are really good.
Yeah, I've only played the first mission of it, and I wonder how many there are, because it was pretty in-depth. It was, you know, like, similar to a Phoenix Wright kind of case.
There's like 6 or 7.
Wow, okay. There is a lot of content in this game, isn't there?
There's at least 5, and I think it might be 6.
Wow. Yeah, the first one was, I mean, I probably spent an hour and a half on it at least.
Yeah, the last few are really long.
Wow. Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. I like the interface for it. I like the story. It's mostly based not so much on, like, pixel hunting on a crime scene or something like that. It's mostly based on thinking about how the evidence goes together. And then not only, I mean, you can't just, it's funny because the game quizzes you on what you just suggested.
Yes.
So if you combine two pieces of evidence, you know, it was Colonel Mustard in the attic with the pipe or whatever, but you combine a couple of different pieces of evidence that you think might relate to each other. Well, if you just are kind of randomly just scattershotting it, you know, just kind of basically spamming it and trying to combine everything with everything to see what works, then it's going to ask you, okay, why? And it'll give you a multiple choice quiz.
And you're like, oh, crap.
Yeah. And you have to, like, think about it and say, oh, this is why they're connected. This is why I think this might be the case. And so you actually have to kind of think about what you're doing. And if you choose wrongly there, you lose a heart. I don't know what happens when you run out, but something bad.
You go back to the last checkpoint.
Okay.
And checkpoints can be kind of far back.
Yeah.
So anytime they do like a major like long period of video, that's a checkpoint.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, what I like about it is that it does kind of encourage you to actually think before you act. And that's surprising in an investigation because there's not a time limit. There's not seemingly not that much penalty for making a wrong guess in terms of the case because that doesn't make sense. I mean, you're investigating a case, you're supposed to come up with wild theories and think outside the box. But once you do, and once you kind of throw out a theory and try to make some kind of logical connection, it actually requires you to back it up and like kind of explain it, which I was really surprised by that. It's not like anything I've ever done in Trauma Center before. And in some ways, I think it's actually better than anything I've played in Phoenix Wright.
Yeah, I honestly think that that game proves how you could do a Phoenix Wright game on a console.
Yeah.
And I honestly, if people at Capcom didn't play that game and go, "Hey, Phoenix Wright 5, what the fuck are they doing?"
Yeah, I mean, just to wrap up Trauma Team, I like it a lot so far. I think the added variety is really good for it. Some of the stuff surgically is stuff that I've done before, and with the last game on Wii, New Blood, they did a great job of sort of coming up with a lot of non-sci-fi surgeries that I think at one point you do brain surgery in New Blood, which is
Really?
interesting. It's creepy and like really high stakes feeling and just looks different and feels a little bit different from anything else you've done. And so I'm hoping that the surgery half, I mean, it's about half, you know, two or three of the doctors probably do fairly traditional type operations like you've done in the previous games.
Yep, it is exactly half do traditional stuff.
Yeah. And I hope some of that will continue to kind of push the boundaries because I'm okay if there's a lot of sewing up people's arms and legs and, you know, excising tumors from their intestines, but I've done so much of that in all the Trauma Center games that I'd rather that be a really minimal part of it. And I like the surgery stuff, but I want there to be new surgeries or just more interesting and advanced surgeries. But the story stuff I do have to mention briefly because the characters are definitely memorable. I mean, it's very
Yes.
anime, but not in a super annoying way.
It's just silly.
They are exaggerated for sure.
Oh,
And
yeah.
the way the story's told is better than in the Trauma Center games, I would say, just because there's more animation, but it's not really that the characters animate per se. It's more
No.
like it's done like a comic panel in a Ken Burns style. So basically, you've got this comic panel. There's like a background and a foreground and some characters, and they all kind of move in parallax. So the camera will sweep across it, but it gives it a 3D effect because the background rotates more slowly than the foreground, you know?
Right.
So it is very much like Ken Burns, where, you know, the camera zoomed in on a photograph and it just kind of sweeps across it very slowly. So basically, you can make an entire documentary of like the Civil War, even though there is no movie footage of the Civil War. That's what it feels like with Trauma Team because it's all basically still comic book panels, but they're always trying to give it some kind of motion feel, even though the characters don't really animate. And I'm okay with that. It's more interesting than what they've done in the past, which is just talking heads. Well, they're talking, but their mouths aren't moving, you know, in the
Yeah,
old games.
it seems more colorful in this game too. Like the worlds, the stuff they animate might be a strong term. The stuff they draw is really colorful.
Yeah.
Like the settings and
Well, there's
things.
just more backgrounds because before it was always like a hospital hallway or
Yeah.
an operating room. And this time there's definitely, you kind of see more of their offices. You see more outside areas. And
You see Japan. I mean, come
there's
on.
just, there's basically just more illustration to it. I mean, I forget which Trauma Center game it was where two of the doctors are, I guess it's in New Blood, they're kidnapped and they're like held hostage and they have to do surgeries in like a jail cell or something. It's a pretty insane premise, but it really, the game can't sell it because there basically is no art. Like, it's just character portraits. It's that and their voice. It's like a radio drama, basically. So I feel like with Trauma Team and in the new art style, the new way that cutscenes are sort of storyboarded, is that I think that same kind of scene could actually be pulled off a little better here. I haven't seen anything like that yet, but I feel like it's probably coming, so I'm looking forward to playing a lot more of
Yeah,
Trauma Team.
there are some action stuff later in the game where that makes it make a lot more sense than it
Right.
would if it was just a still head
I'm
talking.
sure it'll be silly to some extent, and I'm
Oh
okay
yeah,
with that.
it's silly. I mean, the game is
At
silly,
least it'll
but
make sense.
there are moments of drama that are enhanced by the art style.
Right. So in that sense, I think it's a step up. I would still probably prefer just straight up animation. But I understand that's expensive, especially in a game this long with this many characters.
A game that's 20-plus hours long.
Yeah, there would be so much animation that they could probably never actually do that. So
it would have to, it'd be like a whole miniseries worth of animation, yeah, basically.
It's a fair compromise what they've done. It's a step up from the previous Trauma games, for sure. So the other game I want to talk about this week is a rental. I got MotorStorm Pacific Rift. You know, it's a racing game. It's on PS3. Never played the original MotorStorm. I don't really have any interest in doing so, but I know Greg had played some of Pacific Rift, and I guess John has too. I know he was mentioning in emails that he's a really big fan of it. He thinks it's like crazy underrated and awesome. And I like it a lot. I didn't really know what to expect from MotorStorm, except I knew it was a lot of off-road stuff, basically. And what it ends up feeling like, and I guess these games came out around the same time in some ways it reminds me of ExciteBots, but probably a better way to put it is it reminds me of ExciteTruck, because you're driving actual vehicles, you know. They're not all trucks. There are trucks, but there's also like motorcycles and dune buggies and ATVs and monster trucks and a bunch of other stuff. And one of the nice things about the game is all the vehicles feel really different. There's some of them that I don't necessarily care for, but I will say that all of them feel really different, and if you do a race and feel like, man, I did not do all that great on it, the first thing you think is, maybe I should try with a different vehicle, because there's so much interaction between the vehicles and the tracks are designed well enough that it does feel like a lot of times it comes down to a choice in vehicle, and beyond that, it's a choice of which routes you take. To compare it to another game, I have definitely been reminded of Beetle Adventure Racing, just in terms of the number of alternate routes and shortcuts, but maybe not shortcuts, depending on how you drive it and what vehicle you're in, you know? So there's a lot of stuff like that. But like ExciteTruck, you spend a lot of time in the air. There's engine heating and cooling and, you know, going through water and stuff like that. It's really fun. It's very beautiful, and I've had a good time with it for sure. I'm not a huge racing game guy, but if I'm going to play a racing game, this MotorStorm Pacific Rift is the kind of game I want to play. And if you've kind of played a lot of ExciteTruck and a lot of ExciteBots and you kind of want something similar but just more of it and maybe with a slightly different twist on it, I think this is a really, really good way to go. And they're making a new one now called MotorStorm Apocalypse that's, I don't know, from what little I've seen of it, seems to take place more in a city. I don't know how well that's going to work, because part of what I'm really enjoying it with Pacific Rift is that all the tracks are outdoors and they're all off-road, but all the tracks feel really distinctive. I mean, they're all off-road in different ways. I think the people who made this game kind of took the idea of racing on this Pacific island and with all the versatile climates and different topography that you get on, you know, a place like the Big Island of Hawaii, for instance, which is probably the most clear inspiration for Pacific Rift. But I think they really thought about it. It was like, what would it be like to race on the top of that mountain through the base of this volcano with lava flowing over the beaches, you know, through the abandoned sugar plantation, stuff like that. It's really, really good stuff. The track designs are really wonderful. My one complaint would be that the physics are kind of weird. In some cases, there are times when you kind of crash for no apparent reason, or there are jumps that it feels like you should make. Like in video game terms, you should make that jump, but just because the physics, I mean, the action is so based on physics, so heavily based on physics, that you end up, the car will end up tumbling in a way that it would in real life, but it feels like in the game it should be more forgiving. I don't know, Greg, did you get that impression?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're a little bit idiosyncratic here and there, you know, but I mean, in general, they're pretty solid, and I think you get, you know, you sort of adjust your expectations and it kind of works for you. I mean, I obviously played this in lieu of ExciteBots rather than in addition to, but it's not quite as kind of freeform or as kind of crazy as something like ExciteTruck, but yeah, I mean, it is more my kind of racing game in that same way. And as I sort of mentioned when we were talking about Assassin's Creed, funnily enough, I think what I kind of really noticed about it is just how they use the fidelity of the graphics to create these really impressive organic environments where you've got a whole bunch of different routes to go, but it doesn't feel like it's just, oh, okay, here's all the different routes and they're laid out for you. There's an element of, you know, picking them out on the fly and actually deciphering them in the environments because they are so organic. And
yeah, you really have to pay attention. And the fact that you're going so fast actually makes it hard to see all these alternate routes. So there's a bit of tension between, you know, going as fast as you possibly can and even having the reaction time to even take the route that you want to. Sometimes I find that I'm going so fast that I don't really get the opportunity to choose, and I kind of just have to keep going on whatever route that I'm on and just hope that it works out with the vehicle that I've got.
Absolutely. I find that as well. And obviously that is something that you can only really achieve with this level of graphics, but that's what's kind of weird to me about the whole apocalypse idea. It's like, you know, the whole dilapidated urban environment, it would seem even more difficult to achieve a similar thing there.
Yeah, I'm not sure the urban environment is a good fit for the style of game that MotorStorm is, but we'll see how that works out. It's an interesting choice. I think it's kind of a risky choice.
Well, maybe. I mean, it is the third game in the generation. I suppose they have to do something different at this point.
Sure, but I'm looking forward to it, and I want to play more Pacific Rift. I'm having a lot of fun with it, actually. It's a very nice game. So, James, you're up next.
Yes, I have the most awesome dichotomy in the history of the show. So, as alluded to last week, I am a shit ton of pain deep in Sin and Punishment.
Yes.
Enjoying that, huh?
Which is like the kind of game where I want to throw my remote against the wall, and I'm like, all right, game, we're going to try this again. And nobody's going to have to die if you let me through.
Well, you know, that's why there's a wrist strap on the Wii remote.
Well, yes, but see, I take the wrist strap off and throw it against the wall to get mad.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but I'm kind of waiting for a price drop on Sin and Punishment 2. I like the first one a lot, and I'm very glad that I got to play it back when it originally came out. But I am not nearly the level of fan of Sin and Punishment that Greg is. It's a game that I want to play, and probably more than I would in a rental period. So I'd like to own it at some point.
You'll never beat it in a rental period.
Yeah, probably not. Not the way I would want to. And it, from what Greg has said, it sounds like you might want to go through it more than once anyway. So I'd like to own it, but not for $50. I've gotten burned on a couple of games this year. Like, I bought Tatsunoko vs. Capcom because it had such good reviews, and then I remembered that I don't really like fighting games.
You know what, though?
And I ended up kind of trading it back in.
Every time I go to the game store, I see the Tatsunoko vs. Capcom controller bundle for $60. I'm like, I'm not going to play the game, though.
Yeah.
But look at that controller. Oh.
It's a really cool game, but I don't have anyone to play it with. The online's
not good enough.
I'm
like, it's only $10 for the controller that way. And one of these days, I'm gonna go in there to get like Mega Man ZX Advent, and I'm gonna come out with the Tatsunoko vs. Capcom haul and go, what the fuck just happened?
I mean, I think on the issue of Sin and Punishment's value, if you like, I mean, I think obviously, yes, I mean, most people wouldn't be as fond of this kind of game as I am, but I think there's an argument to be made for it being certainly worth the full price, beyond the fact that it is very good, beyond the fact that it does have a number of incentives for replayability, it's got a very clever high score system, but also there just isn't really a lot of this kind of stuff out there. You know, you haven't paid for this kind of game three times already in this console cycle because it is not the kind of game that anyone else is making. But of course, that doesn't detract from the reality that it is probably going to come down in price. So,
I'm not impugning the game's value in general. It's a very personal thing. It's just for me, I'm not sure I'm going to play $50 worth of Sin and Punishment 2. It's just not, you know, doesn't appeal to me that much. I'll get through it once, and then I'll consider whether I want to play through it again on a higher difficulty, and I'll probably have good intentions of doing so and then get distracted by something else.
Yeah, that's the way it is, though. I mean, so at the moment, I think I'm on stage 3 or 4 at this point. I'm very happy that it saves checkpoints, as in, like, a checkpoint mid-stage, you can turn the game off,
yeah,
so you don't go on a killing spree, come back, and it'll pick up at that checkpoint.
That's nice.
I was really concerned it would be checkpoints at every level.
No, the levels are far too long for that. It's not practical.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Way.
I'm like, because even the second level, the one where you go underwater in the tunnel, where there certainly won't be any enemies here, that level is like, if you don't die, it's like 30 minutes long.
There's a good amount of content here. It's pretty epic for what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still only going to be, you know, literally a few hours from beginning to end, but it's certainly much longer than the first one in that region.
But that's if you don't die, because if you do die, it's going to be many, 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 many hours.
If you're playing on normal, you will die a ton.
Yeah, I'm playing on normal, and I'm like, can this be beaten on hard? Is it possible?
I've done it.
Yeah, when I do play it, I intend to start on easy.
Did you just do it through straight attrition? I mean, just like, okay, I only have to make it between one checkpoint on every life.
Like I said, I mean, that was one of the things I said when I first played it, you know, when I had the Japanese version last year, was that it, sometimes on normal, certainly on hard, it can devolve into that. But surprisingly, I found when I replayed it that I actually was able to start stringing things together and actually play for score.
Yeah.
I think it's unfortunate from a pacing point of view that you can kind of get bogged down into that, just kind of limping from checkpoint to checkpoint. But on the other hand, the alternative would perhaps be to, like, you know, have fewer checkpoints or something. That wouldn't work. You know, I think it's best to have the checkpoints there. Yeah. Because it is uncompromisingly complicated.
Yeah, because, I mean, there are some checkpoints that are mid-boss, which is fantastic.
Well, because they have, like, multiple forms and stuff, don't they? I mean,
they have more forms than the final boss of a Square Enix game. It's like, all right, here's my seventh form. It's like, are you fucking serious? Really?
It's treasure.
It's like, he just lost his main cannon barrage. Now he's stronger. I'm like, but he lost his main weapon.
Yeah, but now he's pissed.
There is a guy who, like, I don't know, like he completely annihilated me the first time I tried to get through him, and then I realized his pattern, and I managed to beat him without taking a single hit, and I got to his next form, and he wiped the floor with me in his next form. Like, I think I might have gotten, like, 50 damage on him before he took me out. I'm like, this is fucking ridiculous. I can't take this shit anymore. So then I went on to my other game, sort of the salve.
Right.
which is, at the suggestion of additional staff member, besides what we've had on this podcast, I got Endless Ocean Blue World, which is like the least game I've ever played where I'm still willing to call it a game.
Well, I think it's somewhat more gamey than the first one from what I've heard.
I have to say, first off, I was warned immediately to not spend my money on anything because you need it right after I bought a hammock. So I was like, well, fuck you. You should have told me this 5 minutes earlier.
What do you mean, who warned you? Some, like, a friend or something in the game?
Carly gave me the heads up not to spend any money.
Okay.
She's like, you need it basically to buy the second half of the game.
Oh, God. Okay.
I'm like, oh, man. And then I was like...
But you got a hammock, so...
Yeah, and now I have a hammock, so I'll just sleep. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that game is really slow. Like, maybe it's just because I'm coming off of what is three games in... Because I went Trauma Team, Mario Galaxy, Mega Man Z... Or Zero.
Zero Collection.
Zero Collection. So the whole damn thing. To Sin and Punishment to this.
Quite a turn down. I mean, supposedly the whole point of Endless Ocean is to sort of relax you. And are you finding that it's effective?
Yeah, I can see it being relaxing. I mean...
If you were someone who was physically capable of relaxing, you would find it relaxing.
Yes, if it were in my realm of possibilities, I would certainly be quite relaxed. But I mean, it was pointed out to me that you can press the plus button to auto swim and then cover the sensor with your hand once you point it and just drop the remote and the game plays itself. Which is
such
a weird...
What do you mean it plays itself? I mean, wouldn't that just make you swim forever?
Yeah, but if your objective is go point A to point B, cover it, let it go.
You know, that stuff's been happening for a long time. I mean, you know, we've said before, like in Wind Waker, you can just kind of basically set the wind and then put it down. And
It's just like even more so because it's almost like they built that in as a game mechanic.
Well, you know, the ocean's a big place.
It's endless, actually.
Might take you a while to get across it.
I'm not sure how to even describe this game. I mean, it's got like Pokemon Snap elements to it, literally and figuratively. So there is a camera, but the camera's not really important. But there's the whole collecting observation things. Mm-hmm. I guess I can see the RPG elements, although they haven't really manifested themselves. I still have to surface about the same amount of time. It's got a story that makes absolutely no sense, which is awesome. I appreciate that. I don't know. It's a very strange game. It's very shocking that this is a sequel. That there was one game like this, and Nintendo said, let's make another one.
Right.
Well, I own it. I own the original. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it is relaxing. I do quite enjoy something that is relaxing, that maybe juxtaposed with something like a Sin and Punishment. I mean, it was a bit limited, the first game. Well, it was a real budget title as well. So I guess they kind of acknowledge that. But with the second one, they've got like more different kinds of environments and different kinds of interactions with the animals and all sorts of things.
Yeah. Did Arika make the first game too?
Yes.
Yes, they did, yeah.
What I thought was interesting is when I was watching the opening credits, by the way, the opening song for this game is so bizarre. the singing. I turned on the Wii, I'm like, what the hell is this?
Isn't it like Inya music?
Yeah, it is. If you've not played the game, just go look at it on YouTube. It's kind of funny to watch it. Because it's just so, you just feel like, what is this doing in a game? And then you play the game, you're like, wow, this is...
It fits.
This is like a sleep aid.
Vitality Sensor, Endless Ocean 3.
I know, right. I know.
But it's really a shame Nintendo isn't more hip, because I think actually Sigur Rós would be a great band for this kind of thing. And, you know, going back to, you know, maybe some Pink Floyd material too, not that that would ever be in a video game, but Sigur Rós I can see maybe licensing out for something like this. I remember the first time I ever heard Sigur Rós, I asked Carly about them because she was living in Iceland at the time, which is where they're from. And she said, oh yeah, I really like them. Their music sounds like whales singing. And yeah, I'll buy that. It'd be great for Endless Ocean. You know, if they had left in the MP3 support, you could just play your own off the SD card.
It would have been nice.
That was taken out for some bizarre reason.
Because they took out MP3s out of the Wii in general, basically.
Yeah, but it plays AAC.
They didn't have the substitute feature.
The other observation I had in that game comes from the opening, too, which is a very unusual listing for Iwata on this game, where he's actually listed as the director.
What?
Huh.
Yeah, Satoru Iwata is listed as director of Endless Ocean 2, along with the guy from Arika.
Weird. That sounds like some kind of like terminology.
Yeah, I don't understand. Yeah,
just a weird thing.
I went to do some research on it, but I can't find any explanation for that.
Yeah,
it's certainly an interesting listing, because usually he's always like he's like executive producer or executive producer.
Yeah. maybe the Treehouse let one of their interns localize that credits menu.
Just put Iwata in every credit position.
Yeah. Mike Fukuda is in there somewhere. He's the art director.
My final observation is that the characters in that game are just fucked up looking.
It can't be as bad as the first one in that regard. It was so embarrassing.
Well, I mean, you've got the guy with the flaming wetsuit, which is both literally and figuratively a flaming wetsuit.
Oh. No.
I remember seeing that and I just laughed for a good 5 minutes.
So the fish look great, the people look really bad.
The people look terrible. But it is, I mean, it's a relaxing game. I'm not sure that it's going to be like one of my top games that I've played this year, but it's certainly an interesting contrast between Sin and Punishment and this. Oh, and throw in Mirror's Edge in there, which isn't exactly the most relaxing experience either.
No, it's Mirror's Edge probably made me more angry than just about anything I've ever played.
It's like I had three games I was playing. I was playing Zero Collection, Sin and Punishment, and Mirror's Edge at the same time.
Oh my god, James. You are really a glutton for punishment.
Loving it.
Endless Ocean. So relaxing. There's a reason I haven't re-cracked Sin and Punishment in a couple days, because I was probably about one more day of that trio from having a heart attack.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? Now that you've talked about both games, I actually think it's a very good pairing and totally makes sense.
They are kind of inextricably linked in my mind, because they were, you know, two sequels, unlikely kind of sequels in a way to games that were both announced at that media summit. And then, of course, they were both shown off at E3 together, and I actually got to play both of them at the London E3 event last year.
Actually, at E3 09, they were on opposite sides of the same wall.
You know, maybe I should wait to pick up Sin and Punishment 2 until I can afford it and Endless Ocean Blue World.
But this is a like bundle pack.
Maybe Costco will start like packaging them together.
No, in fact, specifically, they both got the shitty TV to that London E3 event. Like Mario and Wii Sports Resort got the plush ones, and they got the crappy little like 17-inch LCD. So that's sad.
It's true. Yeah, Sin and Punishment 2 was on not a great TV at E3, I think.
They were on the normal TVs that most games got on, not the big TVs that tend to put their AAA titles on.
I want to see my me in 40 inches.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? They had at the current E3, last one, they had like the 55-inch TV for Skyward Sword.
Oh, yeah, that thing was ridiculous.
It was just one giant TV in the entire booth. Everything else was like half its size.
It was ridiculous.
I, I also have started, but just barely started, which I probably won't talk about because I've had enough of this franchise. I caved and bought Mega Man ZX, so, but I'll spare you all that.
That's the DS one.
Yeah, there's two DS ones. There's ZX and there's ZX Advent.
Yeah, that's the sequel, Advent.
And what I found is that ZX you can get for like $12. ZX Advent's like $60.
Ooh.
They're both pretty old, though, by now, aren't they?
Yeah, ZX was really early, and then ZX Advent was like a year later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised they haven't done more Mega Man games for DS since then. I mean, they put out so many on GBA in multiple different series. And if you think about it, the Mega Man output for DS has really gone down.
You could say that about quite a few properties on DS, though, not least like some Nintendo stuff like F-Zero, where they were sort of like perhaps overdone on GBA, but then mysteriously underrepresented on DS. It's quite odd.
And maybe it's one of those things, you know, with the DS piracy and everything. Maybe there were just certain series that were already so low margin. I mean, you know, Mega Man hasn't been really that popular in a long time, so I'm sure they had a pretty small group of people who were buying Mega Man Zero and stuff like that, and maybe...
Yeah, and we call them masochists.
I bought one or two of them. I'm not a masochist. Anyway, we need to wrap up new business, and Greg is going to finish us out with a couple of downloadable PS3 games.
True, yes, I have returned to the PS3 for the first time in probably like a month or something, largely because of Galaxy, or I just hadn't touched it for ages. But there was something I wanted to mention before we got on to that, a little bit of good news. Today is that the Metroid Other M release date was confirmed for Europe, and it's going to be September 3rd, which is in the same week as it comes out in Japan and America. So there won't be any unfortunate lags there, like with Galaxy, or far more egregious ones than Galaxy that they've been in the past. But what are the interesting things in the press release there is they actually put a solid figure on it. It said that there's more than an hour of cutscenes in the game.
Oh, great.
Well, it's a Team Ninja game. What do you expect?
Well, yes, but creatively, it's also driven by Sakamoto at the top. And obviously, so far, hasn't really inspired a great deal of confidence in the cutscenes. Sort of blathering about the baby makes me wonder whether Treehouse is localizing this at all.
I can't wait. I can't wait for this game to piss off all the Metroid fans and I get to laugh at them.
I know, James.
Because it's going to happen, and then I get to go, that and Metroid 2 is a bad game.
I'm sort of gritting my teeth right now in anticipation / dread of Other M.
Oh, I might go bump the Metroid 2 thread just because of this if it turns out to be terrible.
Well, I'm certainly keeping an open mind on all aspects of it because it's better. There's a rush to judgment. You know, sort of both directions from certain quarters about it.
Sure.
I mean, my expectation remains that I'll probably have to just sort of phone it in through the really dodgy cutscenes and then just enjoy the rest of the game, hopefully, and I'd be perfectly satisfied if that's in fact the case, as long as the gameplay is there. But that's the figure, anyway. that was actually new information in a release date press release, so I was quite surprised by that, actually. But yeah, onto the PSN stuff. The first thing I picked up was Super Stardust HD, which is, you know, sort of the asteroid-y kind of twin-stick shooter for PSN. It was a pretty big deal when it came out 3 years ago. It was sort of heralded as one of the PSN's first sort of breakthrough kind of games in many ways, I seem to remember.
Yes, and they're making a new version for 3D.
Well, I came to buy it because they, for its anniversary, 3 years since it came out, they had a sale where you could get the sort of complete package where they bundled together some DLC, which included multiplayer and some extra single-player stuff, for a couple of quid. So, you know, good, definitely a good value. But apparently it also had been updated to run in 3D already. That has happened.
Oh.
Because it actually has a warning on the front of the game that I see, even, that says, you know, oh, if you get, like, you know, headaches or whatever, some sort of nausea or whatever from 3D, do this, that, and the other. So it's definitely been updated for 3D. But in fact, also, that 3D update carried with it performance upgrades that affect the regular game. Not so much just with single player, but split-screen multiplayer actually has a better frame rate now than it did before.
Huh.
Because they've obviously, I assume they had to make some optimizations because you're rendering the game twice for 3D.
Yeah.
And those then carried for over into the split screen mode, which I thought was quite interesting, that people beyond those that have the big setup will actually be able to perhaps benefit from this update. But for me, just play the regular game. Obviously, I really like Geometry Wars Galaxies on Wii. So it's not really any surprise I've enjoyed this quite a lot. I mean, it's different. There's a few sort of wrinkles in there, most notably the fact that you're kind of switching between three different weapons that are differentially capable of blowing up three different kinds of giant asteroids. Basically, you've got like a rock, some metal, and ice types, and then you're switching between the different weapons to get rid of them as quickly as possible.
But you also have that boost function, which makes it feel... I only played a demo of Super Stardust, but I found that the boost feature made it feel a lot different from Geometry Wars, and not really in a good way for me.
The boost function, yeah, I mean, I kind of have used it sparingly just to kind of get out of trouble, because certain times areas of... You're playing on this sort of grid that wraps around a planet in a spherical play field. And, you know, it's at times certain areas of that will get inundated with a whole bunch of crap, and you just want to kind of boost out of there and then kind of regroup and take on everything from a different vantage point, if you like. And that's how I use it. I wasn't like boosting all over the place, even though it does recharge quite quickly. So I don't know whether maybe, you know, some people might have a bit of a temptation to spam it or something, but for me, I did kind of play it still like I was playing Geometry Wars, and then very situationally deployed the boost. But, you know, it's been fun so far. I played through the arcade mode, finished that today. You know, it was fun. I'd yet to be seen whether I'll get into it as much as something like Geometry Wars Galaxies, which obviously got quite a lot more content and sort of variety. But it's good, and for the price, unfortunately, I think that offer will be over by the time anyone hears this, but I was very pleased with that.
That's Europe only anyway. I haven't seen any sale on this particular game in the US.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm pretty sure they did the same thing last year, where it was like on sale for its birthday, so maybe next year, if you didn't get it already. So the next thing I got was Joe Danger. Joe Danger is by four British guys called Hello Games, and it's quite a bit Excitebike-like. You were rating as this sort of past it stuntman guy making a comeback called Joe Danger, who looks mysteriously like a cartoon caricature version of the bald guy from The Thin Red Line.
He does, actually.
Very
see that.
With the sort of, you know, the 5 o'clock shadow and the strong jawline. Very odd.
He looks a lot like a Pixar character, to be honest. I mean, where have I seen that game?
At PAX. PAX East.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, we walked by it a few times, and it definitely looked nice. I didn't get to play it at PAX, but...
It did get very good reviews.
Yeah.
That I've seen.
It has been very well reviewed. That's where it really how I got interested in it, because it sounded like my kind of game. I mean, I do like stuff like, you know, Excite Truck and all that kind of thing. And that's some of what you're doing here. It's kind of a racing game that isn't really about racing. In fact, most of the time in Joe Danger, you're not actually racing against people at all. So you're just kind of, you know, doing tricks and finding different stuff in the environment. I mean, that's a lot of it. I mean, it has this kind of challenge structure where sometimes you'll be like collecting a bunch of stars along the course that'll, you know, require you to, you know, do certain jumps in a certain way, maybe find some little sort of secret areas. Then there'll be other ones where you're kind of collecting coins in a time limit, so that's very much more like a race kind of situation. You've got to, you know, break your neck to get there in time to collect all the coins. And then other times you will literally be racing people. But there's quite a variety of challenges in there. And also, there's surprisingly sort of explorative elements in the game, because, I mean, you have got comprehensive control over Joe Danger. You can go backwards and forwards at any time. You can totally control him in the air. And sometimes with these, like, you can get these, like, hidden stars, which are just, you know, which is just a star on some obscure bit of the course. And you will have to, like, you know, go backwards, exploit something in the environment to go really up high and all this kind of weird stuff. So it's definitely not just a racing game. But, I mean, some of the coolest parts of it that I've played so far is where there's like a trick system in it where you're doing spins in the air, tilting in with the analog stick, or you might do like you use the shoulder buttons to do poses on it while you're in the air. A bit like the kind of tricks that you do to build up the meter in Sonic Rush. And what it's doing is it's building up your boost meter. What you'll find at first is that these kind of two things seem kind of separate, but then as it goes on, when you say, for instance, trying to collect these coins in a certain time or whatever, you'll find that you'll need to be frantically kind of pulling off tricks to build up enough boost to actually go fast enough to achieve the objective. And it's when those two parts of the game kind of come together that I've really kind of enjoyed it the most so far.
Yeah, I mean, SSX has that mechanic too, where you do tricks to build up your boost. And then there's a very simple version of it in Mario Kart Wii.
Yeah, they're very simple.
I like that mechanic. I think it's nice to put a good trick system in there and then actually give you a reason to do them.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, this I think is pretty cool. You can build up boost at will, pretty much. Like if you just want to stop and just do a wheelie on the spot, you will build up the boost. So it's not difficult to build up the boost. But of course, like I said, when you have these challenges where it's imperative that you keep moving, it's a different story. Or indeed, there's challenges where it just tasks you with stringing together tricks for the entire race. It's like a 100% combo, they call it. And it's pretty generous with the timing. It's not necessarily that difficult. But in some cases, it might be difficult to do that while avoiding a bunch of hazards or while trying to do something in a certain time, you know. So again, it's the sort of interaction between the different facets that make it really quite enjoyable. And it's got this, you know, there's again, it's very sort of Nintendo-like kind of approach in terms of the different kind of tiers of achievement and challenges within challenges and all this kind of thing. So you can approach it in different ways. And I mean, there's even some really kind of wacky stuff. Like there's certain levels where I guess they're kind of introducing you to the fact you can do level creation by actually having challenges that require you to edit the level. So you'll be playing and it's like, okay, well, if I'm going to get those stars up there, I've got to pick up this ramp, move it down the track and put it here. And then I can get them. Yeah, it's really quite an interesting way of trying to introduce people to the mechanics of the level editor in the process of the normal game. I thought it was kind of just completely unexpected and funny. And even when you've been playing for quite a while, you see things you haven't seen yet. For instance, like, there's a bit where you just all of a sudden you get this sort of weird bowling challenge where you hit a ramp and Joe Danger just throws himself off the bike into a bunch of giant bowling pins, and that's like a challenge and stuff. It's very wacky, very silly, but I've had a lot of fun with it so far. I've put in quite a lot of time, but I've only got 33% of these stars that you get for doing the challenges.
Wow.
So I mean, it is £10 or $15, which, you know, some people said is quite high. And I guess, you know, I mean, for me, when I'm buying stuff like, you know, Killzone and Ratchet and Clank for not much more than that, it doesn't necessarily look the best bargain in the world, but I wouldn't say it's poor value at all so far on the basis of what I've played. I've really quite enjoyed it.
Well, I have a quick question about Joe Danger. I've heard it described as kind of a Excitebike platformer, and it sounds like you agree with that to some extent, but what I'm a little concerned about is platforming on a moving vehicle. I mean, does that make it frustrating? I mean, in terms of like being able to stop when you want to stop and go when you want to go. And I mean, I'm sure they could work that into the challenge, but it just seems like that could be kind of frustrating.
Well, like I said, you do have very comprehensive control over the character because you're using the left and the right your analog triggers on the PS2, PS3 pad, and you've got a jump button as well that kind of just does a little sort of spring jump, and that can increase your height off ramps. So it's surprising how much control you've actually got. And yes, there are some sort of platformy elements to the levels where you might have like rotating boards that you have to drive across, or quite a lot of springs and targets to hits and things. So there is definitely a pretty explicit platforming element, but it didn't feel like it was anything that was
really mismatched with the control that you've got over the characters. It is really comprehensive. It's much more so than what you normally expect when you're handling a vehicle in a game. So it is weird, but I don't think it's frustrating.
And I guess this is a PS3 exclusive.
It is for now. I mean, there's no obvious reason why it is, you know, technically or because of anything to do with the developer. I think the boys from Hello Games just said that Sony just the easiest to work with at the time, basically. But I can imagine it might find its way onto other platforms eventually.
Well, I'll have to check it out. I need to find a demo.
I'm not sure there is one.
I do have one interesting fact about this game, and I'm not sure this is cold hard fact, but I'm pretty sure it is. To my knowledge, this is the only downloadable game that Game Informer has given their Game of the Month award to.
Not even World of Goo?
But that came out at a busier time of the year, though. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, it's timing's everything with that sort of award.
But I was quite surprised to see a downloadable title get that billing.
I'm sure there were other worthy games coming out at that time at retail as well. It's still no mean feat, I'm sure. But I'm impressed so far, I must say.
Okay, cool. So that's Joe Danger, and that is New Business. Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some of your listener mail with a focus on Nintendo DS anecdotes, vignettes, if you will. We'll be right back. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, this week on Nintendo World Report, we have a couple of off-the-wall blog posts with TYP giving us visual proof of the strange things we get from video game PR agencies. And our own James here, James Jones, tells us what's wrong with Mirror's Edge.
Yes, because I didn't talk about it on the show.
There's some good things about Mirror's Edge, too.
I say what it does well, and then how it shits the bed while it tries to do things well.
Right.
Game reviews are back in full force this week, with Neil offering his opinion of Kid Adventure's Sky Captain for Wii, and Matt Blunden cranking out reviews for 100 Classic Books, and Maestro Green Grove for DS. Plus, Cruise Party and Jet Rocket for WiiWare. Check out their reviews to see what they think.
Well, Jet Rocket actually sounds like a pretty interesting WiiWare game. Cruise Party, not so much.
Zach brings us the first edition of his Retro Revival, a column that looks back at older games as only Zach can do. He talks about his shirts and stuff. I will not have that in my features, Zach. You hear me?
Lord.
The first victim of this treatment is the Game Boy Color title Bionic Commandos Elite Forces. So you get to hear Zach talk about his highs and lows and how his wife strongly disapproves of his wardrobe choices.
Okay, that's all. Be sure to check everything out that we've been posting on the brand new version of NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, we are back for part two. We wanted to do some listener mail this week, but we got a few really good DS stories. We'd asked people going back a couple weeks in preparation for episode 200 for your sort of personal stories or favorite memories of DS, however you want to look at it. And we didn't get a ton of entries, but we did get some really good ones that I wanted to throw out here. So we've got four of those, and then I think we might have time for one question before we probably pick back up on that next week. So, of course, everyone you're about to hear from wrote in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You know, we have a lot of listeners to this show, and most of them have never written us an email. And I just want to send this message out. If you've never written an email, do it. You know, even if you don't have anything in particular in mind, start writing an email, and I bet you'll think of something that you want to ask or something that you just kind of want to call out or throw in there, criticize, whatever. So anyway, the first email we've got here is from Kaitem98, who wrote, I bought my Nintendo DS fat with a PH in 2004, and I actually had to walk a mile to the Walmart near my house while it was snowing to pick up the system.
Uphill both ways.
At the time, there was a game drought going, and I could not afford the DS games that were available. I had to go for at least 2 years with the Metroid Prime Hunters demo as my DS game. I did have plenty of GBA games to use on the system.
Oh, God!
A few months after I graduated from high school, my home was damaged in a fire from an abandoned house next door. The firemen ended up blasting my room with their water hose, and my DS Fat took a direct hit from that hose. For about 3 days, the sound on the DS would work, and I could actually open the GBA slot, and water would pour out like a cup. After a few more days, the sound came back, the water bubble under my touchscreen went away, and the DS went back to normal. Continuing on here, I had to skip some stuff. There were a series of stories here. But finally, KaiTim98 writes, "When I bought my DSi, I found out that it could play iTunes podcasts in the AAC format. That's how I found out about RFN and NWR, and a year and a half later, here we are." So thank you very much for the nice story. It sounds like you've had quite an odyssey with your various DSs and all these things happening to it. Just a quick comment, the story of the fire hose reminds me of when the GBA first came out. I remember EGM did a study where they wanted to flood, you know, everybody was saying that it was a really robust system, it was hard to break, it was childproof, etc. So they actually tried putting it in a clean toilet bowl and then flushing the toilet, which was, you know, basically the GBA was like trapped up against the bowl with all that water, just gallons of water rushing over it and being nice. Pumped out the bottom and then refilling. They took it out, and of course it didn't work because the batteries had shorted, but they replaced the batteries and still didn't work. So anyway, they kept checking back on it. The 3 days later, I guess it had dried out enough, the circuitry had dried out, and they put in fresh batteries, and lo and behold, it booted up and worked fine. And so after that, they named that system Jesus.
I remember back right around 2000, there was back when I got the Nintendo Party Press, there was a letter in there about a kid who had lost his Game Boy Color when he was visiting his family in, like, New Hampshire. And it turns out that his little brother had taken it outside right before a snowstorm and it had been buried all winter.
Yeah.
And when it melted, the damn thing was playable.
Yeah, and KaiTim actually, in his letter, he made some kind of reference to, like, a DS surviving the Gulf War.
There's a famous original Game Boy that survived the first Gulf War, I think, oh. Where it was with all the casings all melted and stuff, but it still works.
It was in an Iraqi bunker that the coalition forces bombed. And it's now in the Nintendo Museum. I think it's in New York, and it still plays.
Wow. That's
crazy. There's some really interesting-looking pictures out there of it.
Yeah, Nintendo do make good hardware, good rough hardware.
Yes.
So James has the next letter.
Yes. Thomas from England, a.k.a. Killer Manjaro, wrote, "In regard to the DS retrospective on episode 200, you stated that the social gatherings which Nintendo conveyed in their early marketing for the DS were generally unrealistic. Until a few years ago, I would have agreed. However, I will never forget the trip to Belgium with my secondary school for the Mario Kart DS antics. There must have been at least 10 people, some of whom I didn't even know that well, with DS systems and a copy of the game, and we all swapped around for multiplayer racing. The races we had, as well as the jovial atmosphere surrounding them, were so much fun, and it really made the 8-hour bus journey pass like it was nothing."
Yeah, I hope everyone's had that experience at least once.
It's a shame, really, because, I mean, if I'd been younger, maybe I would have got to do this at school. I mean, I did play GBA a little bit at school, just a bit of Bomberman, I seem to remember, or like the Mario Advance, Mario Brothers multiplayer game, a little bit of Super Circuit as well. But, you know, with the link cables and just the fact that, you know, just seeing the GBA was tough, it wasn't all that convenient. Whereas, yeah, with DS, that's one of the things that really, you know, obviously the whole online thing was probably more publicized, but the wireless multiplayer was so much easier. I mean, for people who were better positioned to exploit it, I could imagine it would have been a hell of a lot of fun.
I personally have never had the opportunity to really play a lot of these games multiplayer, but I know that there are events like PAX East, where we saw people were just congregating in areas and just playing games that they had on hand, which was really kind of amusing to watch these people like form up circles so they could play Mario Kart DS.
Yeah, it's a very compelling experience if you ever
get to try it. A 5-year-old game, effectively.
Right. That's one of the fun things about PAX is it's all about getting together and playing games with other people, even if they're strangers. And even if it's not even a video game, it could be a board game or a card game.
I really do have to encourage people who have the opportunity to go to either of the two PAXes, since they're both going to be continuing on in perpetuity now, to definitely go to them, because they are – if you listen to this podcast, you'll find something there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I did get to do the Game Boy thing back in elementary school. We would have essentially – we ran the Pokemarket basically on our bus on the way to school every day.
Pokemarket.
It was basically like I had red.
Shares of Pikachu are up today.
Basically it would be like we would negotiate trades the day before, and we would come with the inventory for the trade the next day.
Did you ever throw in a little something extra, like non-digital goods?
No, definitely not.
Okay.
It actually helped that I was the only person who had a copy of Red of the four of us, because basically I could demand whatever I wanted at that point. I was like, you want it? All right, you're gonna have to pay up big time. It was great.
Well, Greg, we're going to have to get you out to E3 or PAX or something sometime, and you can bring Jam with a Band.
We can have Jam
questions. There's plenty of those on the continent now.
Yeah, that's right. Our shipment arrived today. 5 copies of Jam with the Band have just showed up in North America.
It seems like sales of Jam with the Band in America now compare favorably with Europe's take-up.
By the way, in case the IRS or Customs is listening, those were gifts.
Okay, Greg has the next letter.
Yep, the next one is from Nathan in LA, aka Greybrick, on the forums, and he wrote, my most notable DS memories are... I once took a Spanish class during which regular Mario Kart and Metroid Hunters tournaments occurred in secret, and we took frequent visits to each other's towns in Animal Crossing. The hall circus was shut down when the teacher discovered a nasty animation of himself via picture chat. I will leave the details to your collective imagination. It's probably a good job they didn't have Flipnote Studio back then.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably a good thing John and Zach aren't here to tell us about their imagination.
I love the idea of this, like, this covert DS circle going on.
DS Ninja Ring.
Would the teacher think they were laptops or something? I mean...
there's the DSi XL out, you know?
No, right. To be fair, if I had the XL, everybody would be like, wow, it's really bright in this room right now.
And then the next of Nathan's stories is, for a brief moment in time, I was a quote-unquote billionaire in Animal Crossing. I created a tile set that sold for millions of pop. I was able to hire lackeys to pull my weeds and harvest fruit. I have never had such a bizarre online experience. That is quite odd.
That sounds criminal. I'm sorry.
Animal Crossing is one of those singular gaming experiences that I should probably try at some point.
You've never tried an Animal Crossing?
No, not really. I've actually actively avoided it sometimes just because I know the addictive power of it.
Oh, but, my God.
It does seem like people have the craziest stories.
Yeah, I avoided the Wii game, but I got stuck the other 2 times. And both times, I'm like, uh-oh, it's 4 o'clock. I got to get on there and... pull those weeds or I'm going to be in trouble.
God.
And then I'm like, wait a minute. I just set my schedule to a game that stars a raccoon mobster.
Yeah. I think he's a tanuki, actually. Tom Nook?
Yeah, but I mean, it's a manifestation of raccoons, so yes.
Just saying, Dan Bloodworth told me Tom Nook is a tanuki, and that's where his name comes from.
Yes,
it
does.
A tanuki is not the same as a raccoon. It has giant fucking balls.
Wow.
God,
no, it does. Tanukis have humongous nutsacks.
I know.
Anyway.
Yes, and last but absolutely not least... from Nathan's memories here is, I asked a girl out successfully via PictoChat at my college. So there you go.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess they went straight to bed.
Oh, God, no.
Not going to go there.
just like literally picture of a penis, yes.
You're right.
Wow.
There's a drawing of a dick with some hairs coming out of it and the checkbox that says, will you go out with me, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Get your coat, love.
Oh, by the way, this response is to our newest staff member's letter.
Yeah, we should say Nathan Graybrick here was just invited to join our staff and accepted. So this is the last letter we're going to read from him on the show. He's now officially...
going out on a holiday, right?
Yeah, damn straight,
so
man.
Please, for the love of God, write us letters.
You
so
got
we
a
can...
date on PictoChat. That's fucked up. That's awesome.
Dude, look, I ain't going to knock it.
No.
Dude, I'm impressed. I'm impressed.
Yeah. So, all right. By the way, congratulations to Nathan, and get to work. So, the last letter we have regarding DS anecdotes is from Shaman in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, way up north. And Shaman writes, since I lack the depravity to come up with a reasonable explanation for what occurred after the drunk cast, I would submit my favorite DS memory as playing The World Ends With You. Upon first boot up, I was greeted with the most unlikable jerk-ass protagonist humanly possible in a battle system that was nearly incomprehensible even after reading the manual. As the days went by, however, the battle system unfolded in a logical way, and I was able to move the difficulty back to normal on the fly. This game uses every single feature of the DS hardware, even managing to make the accursed microphone useful for a battle or two. So call it a cross between needs more love and a DS memory, but The World Ends With You is a game that literally could only be done on the DS, and everyone owes it to themselves to play it at least once. Very nice. Thank you, Shaman, for the shout-out slash memory.
I love that he described the main character as the most unlikable jackass protagonist humanly possible.
Jerkass, not jackass.
Jerkass.
Jerkass. I love it.
My apologies.
He's very, he's another one of those highly zip-oriented character designs.
The Nomura games, where everybody wears belts.
Yeah,
and
the Nomura
yes.
games.
I think The World Ends With You is kind of the ultimate example of that, but Kingdom Hearts has some pretty severe zipperage going on, too.
This is pretty much like Nomura's swan song at this point. It's like, all right, can I make an outfit completely out of zippers?
Right. I think he seems to be toning it down in the more recent stuff.
I think people just – it just became such a punchline that they eventually – all right, you got to bring that down a little bit.
Well, it is, I think, one of the very few, possibly the only completely original RPG from Square Enix on the DS.
Until Four Heroes of the Light comes –
well, that's still Final Fantasy. I mean, in terms of them maybe trying to create a new franchise, or at least, you know, trying to do like a one-off.
Oh, original franchise. Okay. Well, then yeah, I think it is.
So, I mean, that alone makes me curious. I've always been curious about it, but I haven't played it.
Yeah, I mean, it got really good reviews and everything, but for me at the time that it came out, there's certainly the sense that this was something, you know, pretty challenging for people who are well acquainted with the RPG genre, which I certainly wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
And so I'd be better situated to give it a try now, but it still sounds a bit intimidating.
I've meant to buy it, and then it sort of dropped off the face of the earth pretty quickly.
Well, I would tell listeners to anticipate it showing up on a certain poll coming up in the future.
I would tell listeners to not go buy it until I find my copy, and then you can go buy it.
All right.
With all those GameStops in Virginia, you really have to tell everyone else to sod off.
Well, yes, exactly. I have a big pile of games to play, but you can wait.
Well, I know I have a friend who owns it and doesn't like it, so maybe I can borrow his copy if I need to procure one.
And of course, the review that our site gave for it was handled by Mike Gammon, he of Buffalo fame.
Yes.
And he was not that fond of it and got some hilarious detractors in the forums that came in just for the sole purpose of ranting about his review.
I have to find my The World Ends With You, because any time I shit on a game, nobody cares.
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably the most entertaining talkback thread since Final Fantasy III on DS.
Oh, God.
That's probably the most epic talkback of all time.
I think the Pyongya golf one was pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. There's a whole list of them.
That one actually crossed into the creepy zone a little bit.
Feature idea, James.
What, Stan's crappy
reviews?
No,
you could do like the best of talkback.
Oh, if you're looking for epic talkbacks, that not on our site though, go to Game Trailers giving Kirby's Epic Yarn best graphics of E3 2010.
Yeah. I should go read that, because Dan linked me to it right when he first put it up, and I was like maybe the first person to even watch the video, and so there weren't any comments yet, but he was predicting, he was anticipating.
It's like 12,000 people calling Bloodworth and crew the biggest dumbasses in the internet.
Yeah. Well,
it's amazing.
Dan actually kind of teased me. We went out to dinner with Dan and did karaoke when we were still at E3, and he kind of told us that he's like, don't tell anybody, but we're going to give Kirby best graphics, and the internet will probably explode.
It did. It was so amazing.
Yeah. Well, hey, I agree. It was the best looking game
I
saw.
Didn't they also
the
give it like Game of Show too? I mean, they gave it other awards that caused the internet to sort of stop turning briefly as people just shit all over them.
I mean, I think the extraordinarily warm reception to Kirby's Epic Yarn was quite amusing for me, because the juxtaposition with Good Feel's previous effort, Wario Land, whereby, you know, it's a gorgeous game. I mean, you know, I would say Kirby is certainly more striking, and it was reassuring to me that they apparently cracked the code for widescreen in the interim. But, you know, Wario is a gorgeous game.
Guys, there's a Switch!
And the thing is that, you know, because they didn't show it at E3...
The first time we saw it was in screenshots.
It's a very low-res screenshots coming out of Japan.
Right.
You've got people like Shane Bettenhausen saying it looks like a Super Nintendo game.
Right,
and
yes.
Then flash forward a few years, and Goodfield's next game is getting Best Graphics Awards.
Well,
I mean,
the first time
just...
they ever showed Kirby was in video, and that is the proper way. Because
yeah.
their games are all about animation.
Exactly. It was much the same with Wario, but it just goes to show... I mean, like I said, Kirby is very special and it is more distinctive than Wario, but it goes to show the importance of how you handle the information, how you get it out there.
Right.
It makes a huge difference to how people perceive the game.
I can't remember who I sat next to when they were showing that video, but they undoubtedly heard me just utter when they showed the first, like, 6 seconds of video, holy shit.
Yeah.
Because that was the only words that came out.
It's so close, though. I wanted the Good Feel Yoshi game. It's so nearly there.
Yeah.
And it's not. But I'm still looking forward to it.
Maybe you should just keep writing to every person you can possibly imagine and enjoy your form letters back.
They'll do it. Maybe on 3DS, but they'll do it.
It'll be Yoshi Touch and Go 3DS, though.
Because, you know, they was going about all Kirby has had a console game for 2000. Yoshi's Story was 97, all right? Swivel on it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. My N64 is at my parents' house, which I've discussed is within walking distance of my place. And I went over there one night to get something. I don't remember what it was. My sister was still up, and she periodically pulls out that N64 and just puts random ass games in there. And she had Yoshi Island in there, and she's like, I have no idea what I'm doing. But if I hear them sing this song again, I might go insane.
To this day, I've never played Yoshi's Story.
Yeah, I picked up a used Japanese copy years later for a pittance, just mainly because the box is very nice. I mean, you know, it's so far away from the games I like, which are challenging.
She's just sitting there going, I need to get more fruit. I was like, what the fuck?
It's not without merit. You know, the visual style for that was really quite distinctive.
Oh, yeah, it was like cardboard pop-up book.
Well, with Yoshi's Story, it's like everything's made of something, but it's not all fabric. Mm. Some of it's fabric, like the sewer scenes are in paper mache,
right. Basically,
and then all sorts of different things like that, which is more like Little Big Planet, whereas Kirby is completely consistent. It's fabric. It's all fabric.
That was a complaint I saw with respect to the Kirby talkback threads, was that Little Big Planet already did this, and their response never gets, but yeah, it was just kind of all kinds of crap, and a lot of stuff wasn't really anything. It was just there.
Yeah, it's like cardboard, or it's, you know, it was far more sort of all-encompassing, whereas this is extremely...
This is a gameplay mechanic, effectively. I mean,
and they're working into the games a lot. One of the more subtle ones that I really like is where you sort of go into the background and you just see the bulge of the fabric as they're kind of moving inside it. And so, I mean, you know, it's not as showy as the bit where he drags the screen towards it, but it's also really cool. So.
All right. James, can you read this?
All right, so our only real question this week comes from Philip, who says, Dear NWR, I'm a relatively new listener to Radio Free Nintendo. During your discussion of the Wii Motion Plus in episode 199, you mentioned that there were a lack of any good third-party Wii games that supported Motion Plus. You failed to mention Tiger Woods PGA Tour, which is perhaps the best example of Wii Motion Plus controls on the Wii, period. In fact, Tiger Woods, most will agree, is probably the only real good, quote, serious sports game on the Wii. I've noticed that you guys don't seem to talk too much about sports games at all on the show. There isn't even a review of the latest version of Tiger Woods on your site. I found it odd that you had a lengthy discussion about Wii Motion Plus, and yet there wasn't a mention of the best Wii Motion Plus showpiece. Anyhow, I like your podcast, and the very articulate and thoughtful ways you guys discuss all things Nintendo. It's obvious you've been playing for a long time. I'm 32 myself, and I've been playing Nintendo games in one form or another for the past 25 years, so the mid-80s. So I can relate to a lot of the perspective offered on the show.
Oh, thanks.
The first I would like to say it's very nice to be called articulate. I'm sure if any of us ever run for president, we can consider making Philippia the vice president.
That's right.
Perhaps.
Articulate and thoughtful.
But the case with the Wii Motion Plus stuff with the related to E3, I'm not sure if he's a relatively new listener, whether he'd be aware, but it was explicitly linking back to a discussion we had on the preview for E3, where Johnny brought up the fact that basically EA had done a better job of supporting Motion Plus than Nintendo themselves. So when we were following up on that in the after E3, it was sort of taken as a given that EA support was good, and we're mainly talking about Nintendo's support being insufficient, and then the discussion moved on sort of other third parties without sort of acknowledging EA's support, which is always worth acknowledging because it is very good. And yes. I personally, this time last year, picked up Tiger with the Motion Plus bundle. That's actually how I got my first Motion Plus. Wii Sports Resort came later, of course, because it got delayed. And I can attest personally, once again, that I enjoyed Tiger a great deal with the Motion Plus. I thought it added a lot. Yeah, it is certainly a very good showpiece for the technology. And the review for the new game, this year's game with the Ryder Cup and all that stuff in it, is forthcoming. It will be on the site at some point in the near future. One thing I did want to mention, though, is the fact that as wonderful as Tiger Woods is, and it certainly is, but it, of course, it does not require Wii Motion Plus is the one thing to consider in all this, because it does have a range of different control schemes, sort of increasing kind of complexity and nuance, which begin, you know, with the Wii Motion Plus not even being used. So it is, as good as anything for showing off what it can do. But at the same time, it isn't required. So in terms of when we're talking about cracking this nut of third parties being willing to maybe make a Wii Motion Plus exclusive game like a Red Steel 2 or even Nintendo themselves, that doesn't fall into that category.
Yeah, I think part of the caveat with Tiger Woods is that that series on the Wii had good motion control even before Motion Plus came out.
Right.
So Motion Plus improved it, maybe brought it up to a whole new level, but it's not really doing anything that you couldn't do before. It's just doing it a lot better.
I think it was a very, very significant improvement.
Sure, I'm not saying that it's not, but it's not like it's a kind of game that you couldn't have done on the Wii without Motion Plus, because clearly they did.
Yeah, I do.
Well,
think...
and moreover, they are still doing it within the current games, because as I said, there are these multiple control schemes.
In retrospect, we probably could have been more clear that we meant EA is still out there.
Yeah, Grand Slam Tennis, of course, they did last year as well. I'm not sure they haven't annualized that one yet. But that was not as well received as Tiger, but it's still quite a significant offering when weighed against the paucity of such ones from any other publishers.
Yeah. I mean, they've basically done more with it than most people, but they also have, you know, the most resources to do it with, essentially.
Mm, and I understand they have made more nuanced use of it again in this year's Tiger. I'd be interested to try it out. I mean, I'm not sort of rushing to buy it like I did last year because it was my first Tiger for Wii. And so, you know, a year later, I'm not necessarily as desperate to get it straight away, but I think I may well get it later down the line and be interested to see how they've improved once iterated again on what was already a really excellent control scheme.
I'm not really into golf or tennis video games all that much, but the one game that came out last year from EA that I really thought needed Motion Plus is Sports Active. And, of course, you know, we've got EA Sports Active 2 coming out at the end of this year for all three big consoles. They haven't said a whole lot about the Wii version and what changes they're going to be, you know, specific to how the motion controls work between the two games. And I don't think EA Sports Active 2 is supporting Motion Plus at all. Nothing that I've heard suggests that it is. But part of that is that the new one is kind of played almost without the remote, I think, because that now it comes with its own like dedicated wireless motion sensors that you strap to your arm and to your leg, and then it also has the heart rate thing. So I think the remote is mainly used for like menus, as far as I can tell with the Wii version. And so what will really be interesting when that game comes out is sort of comparing the new controllers, the dedicated controllers that only work on Sports Active 2, to the way it did last year, where it was really trying to use the Wii Remote and Nunchuck in a way that other games had not, by sort of attaching them to your body and using them as body sensors. And it may very well be that whatever tech EA is packaging up in these leg bands and arm bands, it may actually be better than what the Wii Remote could do last year. Maybe there's even a gyroscope in it like you have in Motion Plus. I kind of doubt it, but it's possible. And especially now that that's on three different platforms with, especially, you know, the Kinect version is wildly different. I'm going to be really interested to see how that comparison shakes out, especially how the Wii version compares to last year's, and then how the three different platforms this year compare to each other.
Oh, definitely. But in terms of sports games in general, I suppose we haven't talked about them a lot. James has his occasional NCAA football reports when you pick one up cheap or whatever.
Yeah, and that's just I mean, I'm not big on the annualized games, and I don't think many of us are, except for John, who probably buys them and then leaves them sealed on his desk.
It's a complete collection of Madden NFL.
That's right. It is every Madden ever for every system it's come out on.
The funny thing is, we actually talk about sports a lot on Radio Free Nintendo. It just doesn't make it into the final cut. A lot of times
it's between recordings.
Yeah.
I mean, my biggest issue with sports games a lot is that even if I have, you know, kind of dumb fun playing them, let's call them dumb, but I mean, I just, you know, I can kind of brain off and just throw 100-yard touchdown strikes with crappy quarterbacks. It just doesn't matter. You know, I don't try to be challenged by it. I just do it because I want to see if I can score 147 points on a team. And
that's so boring.
I mean, it's mind off fun, basically. It's just like, it's almost like I'm just kind of passively watching it.
I can't tell you how many years it's been since I played a football video game. I mean, I have played them in the past, but man.
I actually had fun with the Madden demo at E3. I didn't really write impressions of it because Neil has a massive thing he's working on for it.
Mm-hmm. Neil went down to Tiburon and played it in Orlando.
Yeah, so he has a big write-up he's working on for that particular game.
We're going to have pretty robust coverage of EA's upcoming lineup, I'm sure, courtesy of Neil. But for me, I mean, I really enjoyed, for instance, Pro Evo Soccer go back on, you know, on Wii.
Right. We talked about that on the show.
But that was years ago now, and because, as you said, I'm not a big fan of the whole annualizable thing. I haven't felt the need to go out and purchase the new versions. But that's a completely separate from Motion Plus, obviously, it's used because it's you're principally using the pointer for that, but you have really quite innovative controls there, and a completely different way to play a soccer game. So, and give Konami credit as well.
I think the last sports game I considered buying was like Wii Ski, or maybe Wii Ski and Snowboard, the sequel, because that's the only sport that I actually have a really strong personal investment in that I actually play. You know, and I like the idea of like having an entire ski game based around the balance board, and I probably would have ended up getting that if the reviews were really mixed. You had like, I think 1UP gave it an A+ or something, and everybody else gave it pretty low scores, so it ended up being something that just kind of fell off the radar after a while. But I'd be interested in seeing like a kind of a different take on a skiing or a snowboard game for Wii. I mean, I tried Shaun White snowboarding and didn't care for that a whole lot. But I guess that's one of my problems, is that I'm not really that big of a sports nut. And the sports that I do like, I'm not very happy with how they're represented. I mean, I love college football. I'm a big college football fan. But I've never really cared for how football games work. I just, to me, they don't capture the part of the sport that I find interesting. You know, I've talked before about how I think Madden it's too simulation based, and unfortunately the days of like arcade football games are kind of dead.
I would say that the Wii version of Madden is certainly more arcadey than the more traditional Madden games.
Sure, I believe you, but it's not a very strong argument to me. It's just not compelling.
It's certainly more fun because of that, definitely.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up the show now. So a couple of contest winners we should note. First off, the retroactive poll is over, and I want to thank everybody who voted. We had good participation this time, and a very healthy debate in the forum thread about what all went down there. But the winner of our Game Boy Advance retroactive poll is Mother 3. And in 2 weeks, I think, this is tentative, but I think in 2 weeks we will begin our discussion. And I'm looking forward to it. It's a game I've wanted to play for a while, and this is a good excuse. So Mother 3, if you do decide to play along, look for the retroactive forum thread and drop your comments in there, and we'll have a discussion on both fronts. So I'm looking forward to it, and again, thank you to everyone who voted. The runner-up, by the way, is Mario Tennis Power Tour, and that will make a return in the second chance poll that's coming up in a couple of months. So looking forward to that. Finally, we have a winner for our Drunk Cast story contest, and I guess, Greg, I'll leave it to you to crown the king.
Well, there was a late surge of stories, still not very numerous, obviously, as we said last week, but the last few entries were really quite good. I thought there was some really good effort in there. I know there was one from Zap, I think, in the forums, who managed to work in Henry Winkler jumping the shark in me form, which I thought was particularly impressive. we had another one where there was a sort of evil character that was an amalgamation of every terrible game that's ever been mentioned on the show. And of course, Mike Sklens was completely oblivious to who this character was because he didn't listen to the show. There was loads of loads of really well observed gags that let you know that the listeners are out there carefully judging John's penchant for puns. So
yeah,
in the end,
they've dredged that
trough.
Yeah.
That big sty. James and I deliberated between these entries in the end, but we decided that the winner of the King of Clubs, the signed King of Clubs, will be a B-boy, Brendan, who sent in practically a script for a quite adventurous take that also explained why Zelda was delayed to next year, which I know, please, James, no end. So, I'll reassure everyone that that was not the primary criterion for it winning, is it?
No, it won because it had the best lines and it had the most number of lines that I could see myself repeating. I mean,
level of effort.
It was certainly an impressive level of effort. We have casually kicked around the idea of some grand dramatic reenactment of that one day, but wouldn't hold your breath, but
yeah,
if we could pull it off, I think it'd be quite entertaining.
The best part being that I'm not in it, and yet I'm still in it.
Okay.
We also kind of decided that Adrian in England, who sent one in, it was also very impressive. We're kind of kicking around the idea of maybe trying to rustle up the suitably terrible runners-up prize.
Should it be worse or a better game? I mean, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a good question. These are some of the philosophical issues we've got to resolve.
So wait a minute, should the game he get be less comically bad or more comically bad?
We will see. Perhaps we'll give you something, Adrian, at some point, if you want it. But the audio of the incident itself should have reached our entrance by the time they hear this episode. That, perhaps, is the ultimate reward.
It should have reached out and touched them by now.
They will certainly be not listening to this episode at this point.
They'll still be on the floor, comatose, in horror.
And to those of you who got it, remember, I heard this walking the streets of Boston to get breakfast.
All right, that's going to be the episode. Thank you to everyone who wrote in and continues to write in. And of course, thank you to everyone who voted in the poll and entered our little contest there. And I'm very sorry for the people who won it. You can send your questions, comments, and feedback, even hate mail, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We read everything, and we may not get to respond or read it on the air, but we sure do appreciate getting everything, and we will consider whatever we get. So thanks very much. Continue doing that. Of course, before we go, I want to plug our sister podcast. We have the NWR Newscast, which is still wrapping up some post-E3 material, I believe, and Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which is an awesome video game music show that you should subscribe to. I was on the most recent episode, and I'll spoil one of the games we played. It's Super Mario Galaxy 2. Beautiful music, and if you haven't played the game all that thoroughly, you probably still won't be able to figure out which one it is. So look forward to that. Actually, you can download it right now, and I highly encourage you to do so. With that, we are going to step out of here. Next week, John should hopefully be back. I will not be. Don't fear. These guys can hold down the fort. So tune in next time for Radio Free Nintendo. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I can't believe I fucking bought Mega Man ZX. The fuck was I doing? I have no self-control. It's like, what the fuck was I thinking? I spent the last 3 weeks going, fuck you, Mega Man Zero! What made me say, let's go buy ZX? Oh, I'm an idiot.